Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Los Angeles studio guitar player Gary Sult. But first, let's talk about a little survey that Billboard magazine sent out anonymously to label execs all over. And they asked a number of very interesting questions, and they got a number of very interesting answers. The first one was, which artists would you like to have to build your label around if you were just starting a label now? So in other words, who would be the first artist that you would sign to a label? And the number one answer was Taylor Swift, followed by Lady Gaga and Adele. Well, I guess that's no big surprise there, that there are some other questions that actually did hold some surprises. For instance, they asked, which artist should be the head of a record label that isn't already? What do you think the answer was? Lady Gaga. Gaga is a lot smarter than everyone gives her credit for, and as a result, she's the one that everybody thinks should be running a label. The next one was that 62% of record label executives think that they're technologically smarter than the average 14-year-old. I don't know if that's good or bad, to be honest with you. 54% of music execs would take a job with Apple or Spotify if they were given the same amount of money they're making now. That is a surprise, isn't it? And this is the big one. Billboard asked, which music do you hate the most? And what they got was rap music, followed by EDM and pop. That's kind of unusual considering that most execs are actually in that business of one of those, one out of three, or all of them. And finally, the survey asked some rather gossipy questions about Keisha and Dr. Luke. And there's dueling lawsuits here. Basically, Keisha accused Dr. Luke, her producer, of sexual assault and all sorts of other sexual-oriented charges. Dr. Luke countersued. And most execs said, I couldn't be bothered with gossip like this. Let's talk about the music business, which is probably true. Anyway, these are the people that are running our music business. So you have an insight as to what they like. You have an insight as to who they deem as valuable and what they know. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. Go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Also, take your career to the next level with my Music Prosperity Breakthrough program at musicprosperitybreakthrough.com. The next thing I want to talk about is the new update from Logic. There's a lot of people out there that are Logic Pro users. I have to say it's one of the best music creation tools out there, especially for the price. At $199, you can't go wrong. But not only that, Apple has been supplying free updates. And the second free update of the year just came out. And this is version 10.2. And really what they did is they added Alchemy. Alchemy is a synthesizer that has a lot of capabilities and a huge library. It's about 14 gigs worth of sounds. It comes from a company that Apple bought earlier in the year, so the company has included it into Logic Pro X, mostly because this is the preferred platform for dance music creators. So this is a synthesizer that would definitely help them. There's a couple other things that may or may not float your boat, and the biggest thing is that you can now share your music with Apple Music online and also connect directly to Apple Connect, which is the social media aspect of Apple Music that really hasn't caught on. That being said, Logic, as well as a number of other platforms, are now serious contenders to take over from Pro Tools, which there's a lot of mumbling and grumbling that users really don't want to be there and don't like where the company's going. So for instance, you have Logic, of course. Cubase 8 and Nuendo 7 are actually offering cross-grades to Pro Tools users, and Cakewalk did that a little while ago. They've suspended that program now, but don't be surprised if you see both Cakewalk and other platforms, other DAWs, actually institute that to try to get some Pro Tools users away. There's also some other competitors coming up, Reaper and, of course, Cakewalk Sonar, that everyone is examining very closely. So you might see a real big change coming on pretty soon. Look for AES in October, and that will really tell us whether there's going to be big changes or not. with Pro Tools and with the whole DAW landscape. My guest today is Gary Sult, who's played on about 100 major Hollywood movies, as well as some TV shows featuring an orchestra like Star Trek Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager. Gary's one of the few guitar players to experience what it's like playing in the studio with the full orchestra, which is something he's going to tell us about in a little bit. Gary's also been a longtime instructor at Musicians Institute in Hollywood. What's it like to play in front of a big orchestra? I mean, most people don't get that chance.
It's interesting because the sound is different. Usually, when I play a live date, the rhythm section can be kind of buried in the middle of the orchestra, and you hear all the stuff around you if it's live. If it's recording, then it's a little bit different because sometimes you're in a booth, or at least your amp is in a booth if you're playing electric, but if you're playing some kind of an acoustic instrument, then you're still out there as part of the overall sound, and it's incredible to hear all the parts and hear how everything fits together. And to me, the most incredible thing is hearing how the individual composer or the orchestrator decided to stack all the instruments up to play the parts, who gets what part, how he doubles stuff. So to me, that there's no other experience like that, sitting in the middle of all that stuff when it's happening.
How did that come about? I mean, how did you get, you know, a gig like that?
Well, I started off, when I was in Boston for the last couple of years, I played with the Boston Pops off and on, and that was like the first real orchestral experience. And, you know, quite frankly, that kind of scared me to death because it was John Williams was conducting and Gunther Schuller conducted. So all these like heavy guys, and I would get a call to go to Tanglewood in the summer to play an outdoor concert. So you'd get there in the afternoon and they would give you the folder of the music. And for the most part, I was lucky because it was all old standard kind of things like sing, sing, sing and that kind of stuff where I just played rhythm guitar. So all of my nerves and everything were kind of put aside because I knew I could sit back in the back and kind of just chunk out all the stuff. So after I did that, then I thought, well, wait a minute, maybe I can do this a little bit. So I'd always been friends with a composer, Jay Chataway, who did all the Star Trek stuff. I knew him from Boston when he moved out here, and he got calls to do things that he would call me. So when he got the Star Trek gig, then if there was guitar or banjo or whatever, he would always call me for those dates. So that's kind of how I got into it. And then after that, it kind of blossomed into doing tours with different orchestras and playing like with, I don't know, Santa Barbara Symphony and the New West Symphony, and I played in Japan a million times with Percy Faith Orchestra and that kind of thing. So I kind of got niched, I guess, into call that guy because he can do that.
And when you're playing in the orchestral setting, so how much do you actually play? You know what I mean?
Depends.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, if it's like a TV thing, then it's varied from, I've had parts where I've played, say, like 12 string all the way through the cue, maybe a 2 to 3 minute cue. So there's always some kind of activity going on. Then other times, there's parts where you count 48, you know, 76 bars rest, and then you play two notes. And then there's other times where you've got a melody to play, and you, however long or however important that particular melody is, how it fits into the cue, then you could play a whole bunch, not a whole bunch. So it depends on what the writer's looking for and how he's using whatever the instrument is I'm playing.
Were you used as a solo instrument or complementary to other elements of the orchestra?
On the TV dates, I would use anything from a Strat or a Tele or a Les Paul all the way to a nylon string classical guitar or a Martin 12 or a Martin six string acoustic. And I played banjo, I played mandolin. So depends. If I was going to go out and do just a regular live date with an orchestra. I played with Frank Sinatra Jr. for a little while, and that was all basically Frank Sr.'s chart. So that was all just a big L5 to go out and play all the parts on that. So it's varied. It varies from orchestra to orchestra.
And who?
Sorry, I don't have a more concise answer.
No. But who selects the instruments then? Is the arranger basically saying, I think this will sound good on a Strat, or is that you?
No, it's usually the part is written for a specific instrument. And you get there, so if it was a Star Trek date, Jay would call me before and say, hey, what do you think about this instrument, you know, using this or this, and then we kind of figure that out front. So when you get there, the copyist had already copied the part out, and then it would say either electric guitar, or it would say nylon string guitar, steel string guitar, 12 string guitar, banjo, whatever. The type of instrument would be specified. And then we had talked usually out front, well, hey, what about a Strat versus a Tele? Or what about a Les Paul versus a Strat? And then that was kind of there. A couple times I would take, you know, a bunch of guitars, and then we'd play something, and, you know, if we were going to do it over again, sometimes he would say, well, hey, why don't you try it on another guitar? And then they would have a couple to choose from. That didn't happen too often because the orchestra was always so good, they could burn the cue the first time. So it wasn't a whole lot of, hey, let's go back and do this again.
Well, speaking of which, you say burn the cue the first time. So did you have a rundown, or did you just read it off and that was it?
Usually the way it worked was they're all 3-hour blocks of time, so 3-hour dates. And you get there, and let's say within 3 hours you want to try. The goal is maybe to record maybe, you know, anywhere from 18 to 21 minutes of music. So with a lot of that kind of stuff, there was always a main thematic part that was the foundation. And that was usually a long cue that was maybe 2 minutes or so. So we would usually play the long cues that had all of the meat and all the main stuff in it first. Then, as time progressed, you turn the pages over, and all of the shorter cues show up at the end, but they're basically the same theme or the same, you know, harmonic structure or chords that you play, or the same rhythmic thing that you play. So you're basically reiterating other stuff, just, and it tapers down to the shortest guys at the end. You never keep the longest guy to the end because it'll never work.
Did that ever happen to you?
Where the longest guy was at the end?
Yeah.
Not that I remember in a real high level thing. I think I did a movie a real long time ago. I think it was even at like Mad Hatter Studio. It was maybe the first time I ever played at Mad Hatter for this guy. And I don't think he really knew what he was doing. And I kind of remember that we were getting closer to the end of the date and all the music was not going away yet. And then it got to be panic time. That's when we had to start banging them out. And I remember, I think it was one cue close to the end where everybody got it up and looked at it and just said, oh no. But somehow or other it worked, or it didn't. I don't remember, but I didn't get fired. That's all I do remember.
Is there like a horror story you can remember from orchestral date?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I can tell bad stories or not. Most of the things that I've done, I've been really fortunate. There's horror stories that work a couple of different ways. I in the beginning when I was doing these, I would always get pretty nervous and go in and think, oh no, what's going to happen? You know, the composer basically sneezed a bunch of black ink on a piece of music paper and I have to read it, you know? Mm-hmm. And there have been a couple of those, but you kind of figure out how to do that after a while. Other things that were kind of terrible, the one that comes to mind that I can't say who it was or where it was or anything, but kind of a famous guy, I get a call to do a record date, and I usually don't get calls to do a lot of record dates, but this was going to be a record date where guy says, okay, it's going to be basically a big band, and this guy's going to do a certain amount of songs for a specific theme album. Okay. So it was a Capitol Records. So we go to Capitol Records A, and we're all there, and it's all these great guys. I'm looking around going, man, this is incredible. So the arranger who wrote all the stuff wasn't a good arranger at all. So now here's maybe 18 or 19 people at Capitol. The clock is ticking. Dollar signs are just flying away, and we're playing this guy's first arrangement, and it's terrible. And we're all looking around going, ooh. So the artist for whom we were recording was in the booth, and he liked the fact that we could play really well and everything, but he didn't like what his arranger guy had written. So basically, we spent that three-hour block, another three-hour block, and I think another two-hour block after that, kind of going through and fixing all the stuff that the arranger had written and made it tolerable. So needless to say, I don't think that arranger was on anything else. The bizarre thing was when the record came out, all of those arrangements except one got replaced by other arrangements and other guys. But I still get residuals for it.
Nothing wrong with that. Wow.
No. So, but that, I mean, that's the one thing that kind of sticks out to where you say, boy, this is not happening.
Were you ever on a session where there was somebody that just wasn't cutting it?
Probably, yeah. I mean, I think a long time ago, I did things like that where the level of players, the consistency. I remember that kind of in Boston a couple of times where I did a couple of things, and it was kind of an across the map group of guys, and a couple of guys from time to time, yeah, weren't able to kind of hold their parts up. In LA, though, nothing like that comes to mind. And the reason is the fact that the depth of field for musicians in LA is so incredible that everybody who shows up, there's no question that this guy plays unbelievable. It's all about, you know, what's this guy's personality or his style or how he plays. So it's not like, you know, let's call some guys and hope they can play. Everybody in this town, that's not even a consideration. Everybody plays their ass off to begin with.
That's pretty cool. And, you know, it's so different on a record making level where if you work with bands, for instance, there's usually somebody in the band that's weak.
Well, of course. And I think in that kind of method to making a record, I'm not the guy to talk to about, let's call together five guys and you know, block out a week in a room and come up with an album. So where we just go in and shut the door and start banging out an E chord and see where it goes. So all the stuff that I usually do, all the music's already been completed. Our job is just to go in and just breathe the life into it. But I think that, yeah, the guys who are in more of that, let's create something in the moment, and it's your friends or it's, you know, this girl that you've always been in love with, brother that you're trying to get next to or something. Yeah, those, I'm sure that, yeah, there's always going to be that one link that is not going to make it work.
You mentioned before about mandolin and banjo. Did you know those before you started to play in the studios, or was this something that you just felt you had to learn?
But when I was young and I got out of college, one of the first theater gigs, playing for a Broadway show, I still lived in Ohio then, I got a call to play a Broadway show, and one of the doubles was banjo. And I didn't have a banjo, and I had no idea about it. So I borrowed a banjo and went in, and in my opinion, probably did a pretty terrible job playing the part. But it kind of triggered an idea in me that, hey, if you're going to try and pursue this kind of work, you should probably learn how to play a couple of instruments other than just basic guitar, because that's how all the music in Broadway shows work. So amazingly enough, when I moved to Boston, I was kind of broke, and I was teaching guitar lessons in a music store across from New England Conservatory, and a guy came in one day while I was in there standing at the counter talking to somebody. He had this old banjo for sale, and I looked at it, and I remembered the banjo that I rented for that first Broadway show, and I thought, oh, I should buy this, even though I can't afford it. It's probably a huge mistake. So I bought a banjo, and I went and learned to play it then. And I can't tell you how many times, hundredfold, 200-fold, 1,000-fold, that banjo has paid for itself.
So
mandolin I picked up later just because I knew that that would be important. I got a book and I got some stuff and I just started hacking my way through it. And it's probably way not my strongest double by any means, but I can make the right noises on it.
So you feel it helped you get gigs?
I do, because there aren't a ton of guys who can play a bunch of doubles. So when I played Pasadena Playhouse, a lot of Broadway shows, there would always be doubles. And if you were going to get the call and play that kind of music, doubles were very important. And then that's carried over, you know, into playing other kind of stuff. I think the more you can bring to the table, the more of an asset you're going to be. I tell all of my kids at MI, you should be able to bring one thing to the table that nobody else brought, you'll get the gig.
Mm, yeah, you're right. You mentioned playing in pit orchestras. So was that something that you enjoyed?
Yes and no. I like it because it's a challenge to go in, and if it's a real Broadway show, there's 8 performances a week. So you got to go in 8 times a week and not screw it up. So I like that intrigue of, hey, can I sit down and play this and not screw it up today? You know, on the other side of the coin, if it's a show that has a pretty long run, then you just end up playing the same thing. You've got it memorized, and it gets a little bit tedious at that point, to where you don't feel like, oh boy, I'm going to go in, we're going to create something and light it up in a new way tonight. Your job is to go in and make it sound just like the record, so to speak.
You know, I like to go on cruises, as you well know, and one of the things I always do is look at the bands, and there's lots of bands playing. There's a pit orchestra, and there's, you know, for the shows, but, you know, there's numerous styles and types of bands in all the lounges and clubs. And I like to look at the eyes of the players, and you can tell who's been there for a while because it's a blank stare. It's like, oh,
exactly.
I got to do this again.
Yeah, because now it's not, you're not playing for the love of music. You're not playing for the art of music. You're not playing for the creative moment. You're playing because it's a job. And when it turns into a job, then obviously, yeah, you get those looks and you get that reaction because, yeah, the guy's there to make his rent. So, and that's okay, because on the upside, the guy is making a living in hopefully the area that he likes being in as far as being a musician. But the downside is, yeah, if he gets to be to that point, it's time to move on and find the next gig.
I remember playing in clubs, and this is a long time ago, but, you know, playing 5 nights a week and after a while, or more, and after a while, it's the same songs that you're playing, and it felt like a job. It was no fun after a while. I mean, at first, you have the thrill of doing it, but after a while, it's like, oh, God, not again.
Right. Yeah. It's hard, you know, to get it up every night doing the same exact thing, because you know that it's basically going to be the same exact thing. So if you do have that creative gene in you where, hey, what if we stretch this out? Hey, what if we play it in another key? Hey, what if we do something a little different and it doesn't fit into the program? Yeah, it gets to be dumb. But if you've got discipline and you appreciate what you're doing as a musician, and you somehow or other you slug it out, keep it going, and you always keep that one eye wide open looking for the next gig.
I want to go back to when you're playing on movie scores. How often would it happen where a composer would say to you, I don't know, just try something. I don't know what to do here. I kind of know what the sound is, but I don't know what it is. Did that ever happen to you?
It happened once. We were doing a Star Trek date, and I can't remember the name of the episode, but it had a banjo. It was a flashback to an old guy, and for some reason he played banjo on some weird planet or whatever, and they didn't have an idea exactly what they wanted as far as what this guy would do. So at that point, the composer had written some things out. We did that, and didn't seem like it was quite happening. Then that's when he said, well, hey, why don't we try something else? And actually, there were a couple of they brought a little bit of film with them, so I could kind of play the picture a little bit just to try to see what the guy was doing and see if I could make some noises that might fit what had already been shot as far as the film aspect of it. But that was one of the few times. For the stuff I got called to do, it was always pretty much, here's the piece of paper, here's the notes, play.
Boy, playing to film must be tough, because it's hard enough doing dialogue replacement where you have the script, you know what you're going to say, you're just trying to match it. But coming up with something on the fly that matches the fingers on the picture, that must be tough.
Well, yeah, it's not easy. Unfortunately, I remember that particular situation. It wasn't an orchestra date. It was just me, the composer, I think one of the producers of the show, and the director that were there. And we just did it at some little studio in Hollywood, kind of, on the fly. So everything was kind of recorded just wild, meaning that turn the tape recorder on, let's go. No click. No, cues or wipes or any of that kind of stuff.
How many movies do you think you worked on?
I don't know. Not a lot, probably less than 100, but a fair amount.
But a lot of TV. So, for Star Trek, for instance.
Yeah. That was the cool thing that I was able to do, because I had a relationship with the composer and he was always really good to me. So it worked out. I was very fortunate to do that. And I think, if anybody listens to this thinking, well, hey, how do I get into that? My best advice is go out and meet young guys who are trying to compose music for things that you want to do, befriend them, offer to play, on their demos or whatever for free. And then if one of those guys hits, he'll probably call you. It's not like in this town, especially, hey, we're going to do a movie and we need some music and we need to hire a guitar player to play on some of the music. So what should we do? Should we go get the Musicians Union book and go through all the names and hopefully we find somebody that's open? I mean, my last name begins with S. If it were that way, I would have never worked once in my life. I think it's a lot about relationships. There are a couple of guys in town who are the top guys, and there's nobody literally in the world any better than these guys at doing what they do. And their reputation certainly precedes them as far as, yeah, let's see if this guy's available and call him. But after that, then, if you're a guy like me who can play really well but is not one of those A guys at that level, then how do you get it to work? You get it to work through relationships.
That's probably the same with everything in the music business, I would say. And probably in life, really.
I would say exactly. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't think most people, whatever they do in life and whatever they're successful at, it wasn't because they got a blind call from somebody someday saying, hey, we need a, you know, we need an executive vice president for Bank of America. Are you available?
You mentioned before about starting a relationship with a composer. And that works, obviously, but that whole business has changed as well, where it seems
I
like
agree.
There's a lot fewer jobs than there used to be. There's a lot more composers than there used to be trying to get those jobs. So that's tougher than I think it used to be, don't you think?
Oh, I think exactly, because in, you know, when I started out doing this stuff, which was probably, I don't know, 35 years plus ago, there were way, way, way fewer composers that were adept at writing for television or writing for film or whatever, because all of those guys learned their craft from a traditional standpoint. They studied orchestration. They probably had multiple degrees in music. They studied composition. They had probably a school orchestra that they could write for and have the orchestra play their music to see if it was good or not. There wasn't any kind of digital or singular way that they could create music by themselves. When MIDI came, that changed everything, because now you could say you were a composer and you could certainly create music, and you could create music for different kinds of things such as television or film or whatever, and you could do it with a, in a way that you didn't need a whole bunch of live guys to play, and you didn't necessarily have to know what the lowest note on the bassoon is and what's the difference between an English horn and an oboe. You could dial up some sounds, and if you had good ears and you had some good sensibility, you could try to make music that way. Still, calling in some guys to sweeten it so it still had that real guy feel. Now, with music education and all these colleges that are churning out supposed film composers or video game composers or whatever, yeah, there's a huge glut of composer people, and I think there's still work, because there's work in different areas that existed when I started out. There certainly were no video games or any kind of composing opportunities like that. So that's good. There was no internet. There was no way that you could put music up and sell it that way at that point. But I don't know. Technology is an interesting thing, because it's opened the door for a lot of people to have an opportunity to become a composer. It's also opened the door for a lot of people who fancy themselves a composer but really don't have the skills or the affinity for it to still be out there in the race. So I don't know. You know, it's hard to say. It's different conditions, it's a different set of steps that you have to build for yourself to walk up now than when I started this.
You know, what's interesting is I always look at those things as, well, it's just another evolution that's happening, and the people that are coming up today don't know any different, you know, so is it harder or more difficult or easier? Well, it's probably the same, because they're viewing it, you know, from much the same window that we were, only, you know, the scenery's moved a little bit.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, music, if you're going to really do it for a living, for your life, to have a career, music's never been an easy choice. And anybody who makes that choice is either, number one, out of their mind, or number two, they have to be unbelievably persistent and tenacious in standing up and getting used to everybody saying the word no to them thousands of times, but still pushing forward. Then, somehow or other, they find their little path. They can go down the path, and it works. But yeah, it's, you know, now it's just a different path. I think the no aspect turns into there's a sea of thousands trying to walk down your path. But if you're adamant about what you want and you're willing to never take no for an answer, I still think there's opportunity for young people. just a different pack.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with you. And again, it's not discouraging them. I mean, there's more than ever people trying to learn this stuff, you know, on all levels.
Well, yeah, because it's an incredible opportunity for people that you know, when I was in college in 1970, you couldn't go out and buy your own, you know, a digital recording system and sit at home and try and record stuff. There were basically like two-track Radio Shack cassette recorders that were portable that you could take to a rehearsal, take it home, listen to it. And it had, you know, it had the fidelity of opening a refrigerator. But if you kind of heard what you were playing, it was sensational. So, you know.
It's relative.
That's the difference. Yeah.
Okay, last question. So what's the best piece of business advice about the music business that you either learned in your time in the music business or someone imparted to you?
Two things. Number one, I had a guitar teacher a long time ago when I was starting out, and this guy could play stuff that I had no clue how he was doing it. And I was looking for, hey man, how do you do that? Show me that lick. How do I play that? And then I would say, well, how come I can't do that? And his answer to me, and this guy was as right as the day is long. He said, you know, the only difference between you and me is hours. If you put in a lot of hours, you'll always move forward. You'll always be able to do what you want to do. So my best advice to young people, number one, is put in as many hours as you possibly can. That's what separates you from the guys who are the seasoned guys out there doing it. Because all they've done for years and years is do what they do for hours and hours and hours. If you do that, you got a shot. My second piece of advice to young people starting out as far as business is save your money. If you get something that works out and you get a little bit of money for it, always put some of it aside. Because you never know if that's going to be the last gig you get. You never know if it's going to be 6 months. And if you go out and think that once the tap has been turned on and it's never going to close, you're a fool. Save your money, invest your money, always live below your means. Then, as a business person, you'll be successful. Thank you very much.
Great advice, Gary. Thank you so much.
It's true. It's common sense.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Again, it's probably true in every aspect of your life. I wish I would have learned that earlier rather than acquiring a lot of gear along the way. I'd probably be better.
You and me both, but that's why I'm saying it in retrospect. So, you know, it's never too late to learn.
Thanks for us for doing this. This is awesome.
Hey, always a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. Thank you kindly, Steve. He helps put the show together. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com or find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.